Hello, and welcome to the Architectette podcast. I'm your host, Caitlin Brady. Architectette is a podcast that illuminates the lesser heard stories of women plus in architecture and related fields. Welcome to season two of Architectette. Thank you for making our first season so successful as we featured over 39 unique voices in architecture and other design, engineering, and construction industries. We have many more women plus to feature, so we're gonna get right to it. Our first season two guest is Giselle Santos Rivera. Giselle is Director of Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at HKS, and is also a former AIA DC chapter president, co-founder of La Idea, and Wheeled event founder. She is a natural community builder and has been heavily involved with JEDI initiatives both on a local and national scale, for which she has been recognized with numerous awards. On today's episode, we talk about how Giselle crafted her career path in terms of employers and project types to better align with her interest to design spaces that heal. We talk about how Giselle created communities around her interests and identities, and how her leadership elevated others, but also ended up opening doors for her. I asked Giselle about the specifics of her role as JEDI director, how she splits her time, her current initiatives, JEDI-focused client work, bridging difficult conversations with clients and colleagues, and her tips for those interested in starting a JEDI movement at their own companies. We close out by talking about the circular benefits of mentorship, and Giselle tells us what Hogwarts house she would choose. If you're curious to hear more details about Giselle's journey and are interested in JEDI movements in your own circles, you'll enjoy this episode. All links will be in the show notes. Enjoy. Welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be in the podcast. I've heard amazing things about it from other people, and I know it's amazing. So I'm very grateful that you've honored me with this opportunity to be part of your podcast, because this is the start of, I'm sure, a really spectacular and stellar career where everybody's going to know your name. So I'm glad. I'm glad to be part of the very somewhat the early stages of this amazing space that you're creating for many of us. So thank you for that.
Oh, well, thank you. Honestly, most important is to get everyone else's name out there. That's kind of my goal of of showing architects and people adjacent to architecture doing really cool things. So I love that you're an architect, but also you have a huge focus, and we'll just call it probably JEDI for the rest of the conversation. But if anyone's unfamiliar, it's Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, abbreviated to JEDI. So what is your background in architecture, and then how did you come to have this focus in JEDI today?
I am an architect and a medical planner. I actually started working in the industry at Smith Group, and I started in workplace doing really interesting buildings. I remember the first project I did was a 1 million square foot office building, class A office building with some progressive collapse. And that was a while back. And it felt, now looking back, I am amazed at the amount of opportunity that I received very early on. But I wanted to do international work, so I transitioned to HOK because they were doing amazing work in the Middle East and abroad. And I got to do really spectacular, never have I seen it, nor will likely ever see it, but really phenomenal work that was really heavy design, really beautiful design. We were really thinking about moving the needle in design and being innovative and provocative, which is very exciting. But then I realized I wasn't going to be able to see many of these projects. So I went back to desiring a way to give back to the community. So that's why I co-founded La Idea with many other Hispanic and Latina architects, because we wanted to talk about architecture in our native tongue and in Spanish. And we wanted to be able to help support the local community in DC. There's a big portion of Hispanic community. So we really wanted to find a way to provide visibility to the community and ourselves, and connect in a way that empowered young, hopefully still bright-eyed young people into considering architecture as part of their future. So that was my intro into sort of being back in the DC area and enjoying a way to be an active contributor to what was happening in the local community. And transition to doing some justice work, which now in hindsight made me also understand the power that we can have when we have a voice at the table. But I also recognize that that kind of work was not speaking to my soul, even though I will do it and I appreciate the value of it, especially when some clients aren't necessarily, especially in P3 projects, will not necessarily consider how impactful their spaces are in building justice and equity in the built environment. When we're at the table and we are able to say, this matters, and this is why it matters, that was very important. But also it made me realize that I wanted the opportunity to design spaces that help people heal. So if people have heard me speak about this before, my undergraduate is in biology. I started in genetics. I thought that I was going to be a geneticist. Then I realized I hated working in a lab. My mom and father have been in healthcare all their lives. My mom is a pediatric dentist, but she worked in the university hospital and led the pediatric orthodontia program. My dad is a hospital administrator. So I grew up in hospitals, not the best design hospitals. So for me, designing a hospital reminded me a little too much of the things that I did not like about architecture. And it didn't occur to me right out of school to think, well, I know what I can do to help change these spaces. So it took me a little while after I denied all that space to go back and realize, I like this. I like the opportunity of being part of healing, of allowing people to feel like they can thrive in these spaces and consider what I could do as an architect and use my skills as an architect to help build a healthier lifestyle for people and healthier communities and healthier spaces. So in doing all of that, in thinking I want one thing and then transitioning to another, which happens to many of us, I'm sure, I found myself constantly seeking out a village, seeking out people that understood what I was going through as a woman, as an emerging professional, as a woman of color, as a lesbian and part of the LGBTQIA community. And also, English is not my first language. I grew up in Puerto Rico and went to school in Puerto Rico and then did my graduate degree in Syracuse. I was always seeking my village, my community, people that I could really talk about the issues that I felt I was experiencing and understanding them through the lens of some cultural sensitivity that not many people may have understood the way that I saw the world. I didn't realize that that's what I was doing, of course, as I was in that trajectory, but building the committee La Idea, recognizing its impact, it's still alive and thriving. They still do amazing programming, and recognizing within the Women's Leadership Summit that there was always a space to consider leadership in emerging professional spaces. So that's why I built WIELD, Women Inspiring Emerging Leaders in Design, in that time. And I think creating that space, it just triggered something in me. It inspired me to consider, much like you, how do you create spaces to elevate other people, to give them a platform, to listen to those amazing stories that we rarely share with each other. And I think that gave me some visibility, even though I was definitely not seeking my own visibility. I just wanted to hear the amazing stories that I just wanted to feel energized and inspired. And inadvertently, I ended up in the spotlight myself because I was moderating and hosting these events. And I think when HKS recognized that they wanted to do something internally that supported gender equity, that I was doing that work and everything aligned at that moment. And I just thought, I can't pass up the opportunity to be part of a new structure at a top architecture firm in the world that supported environmental social governance, that wanted to create an infrastructure that supported that, that embedded that in the organization. And they had thought of me because of all the things that I was doing as the person to help guide and frame this conversation. And even though I knew that it was going to be challenged by frameworks and corporate America that I had no idea what it was about, I thought, I'll just treat it like a committee. It's going to be great. We'll do committees and we'll get people involved. And I thought, oh, I have some of this experience. I'm on the board. I'm doing all of these things. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. But I envisioned myself saying no and regretting it for the rest of my life. So I decided, well, I'll jump into the deep end. And one amazing thing that happened at that time was that the CEO sort of told me, we don't know what this needs to be, but we have faith in you and we trust you and we'll build this together. So you let me know what you need, what this should look like, and we'll figure this out together. And that moment made me feel so supported. It made me feel like I had a bit of a net to fall into just in case, and that he would have my back the entire time. And he placed people in my path that were supportive as well. And I was allowed to take my time for an entire year to understand HKS through a different lens, to understand who I wanted to be as a leader, because it was very different than being in Revit and medical planning, and how I thought of myself in that role, but how I also saw HKS as a large global firm utilizing all those resources to not only impact our firm, but also potentially lead, although we are part of a cohort, of course, and there are other firms that were leading in the space prior to us, but I wanted to envision, what would it look like if we were leading? What would it look like if HKS really committed to this? And I had the Chief Sustainability Officer, the co-directors of Citizen HKS, our public interest design pro bono arm. We were all in this collective aligning with our CEO's strategic vision. I could not say no. I still can't say no. This is sort of amazing. And it motivated me to find who I wanted to be in the space because of what I had not seen in the industry as I was moving up.
Mm-hmm. Wow. A couple questions about that. You were already working at HKS when then you were elevated to this position.
Yes.
And so is your work totally Jedi focused right now, or are you still working on some projects?
So that's a complicated question. And it depends on the time of the year that you ask me or the year. I started with 50-50 in mind. And that was a recommendation by Rosa Chang and Gabrielle Bullock, who were in similar roles, although they were principals when they took on the role and I was an associate. They were very helpful in providing me with some context of their lived experiences. So I asked for 50-50 and it was easily granted. And I was managing first listening. I wanted to listen. I wanted to understand what the framework was for environmental social governance or ESG. I wanted to understand my place within the talent team or the talent space and enterprise within HKS. And I was still doing projects. I wasn't part of a big scale projects. I was doing several renovations. So it was easy to manage both. And that was 2019. And I started to notice that it was hard for me. And I hear this often. It was hard for me to transition between Jedi work and project work, like taking off a hat. Emotionally, you just have to change so much of your mindset to think about some technical aspects. And of course, architecture is not all technical, but thinking about a deliverable, a product, the built environment and technical issues and designing, and then having to take off my hat and think about how to best support people and how to help them thrive and how to build programming that they could relate to and utilize to build capacity and build culture. It's like two sides of the brain. So it was hard for me to manage doing both. And I was at the end of that year, I think it was sort of January, I was thinking, okay, I need to have a conversation about what this is going to look like.
Yeah.
Am I going to ask for help? Am I going to distribute the work? And then the murder of George Floyd happened in May 25 of 2020. Not even including the pandemic, where we all had to manage how do we help people and support them when they are home, the technology issues, the inclusion issues, how do we get people to feel like they're part of something?
Yeah.
When that happened and the first conversation was, okay, do we have a position? Should we have a position on this? What is our position on this? If we are saying that we value environmental social governance and that that relays completely to the UN Global Compact principles around labor, anti-corruption, human rights, and environment, and the sustainable development goals, and reduced inequality and gender equity, we should already have an idea of our position in this conversation, even though it's very challenging. So as things started to progress, and I was starting to get asked questions about, you know, how do I help? We don't want to elevate people that are facing right now, many of them facing trauma, especially people of color and BIPOC. How do I create safe spaces so that they don't have to share their trauma, but we're still educating people? And I'm in that place, but I took on this mantle, like this torch. So what are we going to do? I went back to the CEO and I said, I think that I need some time to do this full time until I understand what the infrastructure is going to be within the firm to best support all the conversations that are happening and will likely potentially happen. So I transitioned to 75, then I transitioned to 100, then I went back to, interestingly enough, a repeat client. So I was sort of doing a little bit of work. And then I realized that there was a space for me to do JEDI client work. So right now, it's kind of a mesh of everything, depending on what's happening. But the best thing is that I have the agency and I'm given the flexibility to define what that's going to look like for me, given what's happening at the firm. So if there is a healthcare project that speaks to my heart, I will likely not be a full-time medical planner, but I can get involved and help support. If we're working on a transit-oriented community that's very community-focused and they have a very clear JEDI agenda, then I would love to be part of that. And sometimes I can. So I am mostly enterprise, aka non-billable, but I would love to be able to transition the work that I've done internally at HKS in support of clients, which will look a little different, like advisory. We'll see. Whatever comes my way, I will tackle.
That's interesting that right now it's non-billable, but there's a potential that it could be linked into client work. During the pandemic, jobs and, you know, people have been laid off. Then there was that boom of hiring and then another round of layoffs. And I think especially in tech, we saw a lot of people who were hired for that JEDI focus of representing the firm. They were the first to feel the swing of the axe when big tech especially was looking to lay off a large portion of their workforce. Is that something that you fear for your job too? If you're non-billable, like if we have to cut people off, is your job at risk?
I do not believe that at HKS or many other organizations, our job is going to be at risk, because we still recognize that our industry is not in a place to support all clients and all communities how they need to be supported. When my job doesn't need to exist, I will be happy. I will happily take this torch and turn it off. But I think right now there is an understanding that there is work that needs to be done internally in order to meet expectations that not only our clients and our people have, but we have for the built environment. And there we have to navigate it. I will say that there have been conversations about how there is pushback, the willingness and the openness and the sort of open door. I've started to see and hear from other colleagues that it's shifting, but it's also sociopolitical. We know what's happening in Florida, where a lot of public funding has been removed. It's happening in Texas. It's happening in other states. So we are also having to react to clients in the public sector where these conversations either can't happen or they have to be very, very nuanced. And we can't expose ourselves to the risk because ultimately we really want to make change, and making change happens in many different forms. Sometimes you have to find a way to embed some of these things within the conversation. Sometimes you can be very overt and very open. But the nuances and how to tackle those issues likely still need somebody, whether it's my role or somebody in leadership, to take this on, to navigate how we're going to do this so that we still are engaged with our people, because our people care a lot about this and don't necessarily sacrifice the business. We don't have to, and we shouldn't. So it's a complex thing that needs to be balanced. But we had this conversation. I'm part of a group, which is sort of broad, but it's part of the AEC industry around DEI networking that Kavitha Matthew started from KPF. She's fantastic. She sort of asked us to start having conversations to help her with her role. So we meet regularly, and we did ask. In a previous session, we asked, how are you feeling about your job security? How are you feeling about the work that you're doing? And the vast majority of the people said, I do not feel that my job is at risk. I think many organizations still value this work, understand our responsibility as architects in health, safety, and welfare. And embedding those things is very critical and important. There are challenges, of course, depending on where you are in the country, political affiliations and beliefs, because this is very politicized, unfortunately. But I think overall, and I saw a meme today, DEI is not dead.
I agree. Is there a way that your firm is approaching kind of what you were talking about? There are certain states that do not want or do not welcome certain people of many different backgrounds and affiliations. If you have a client that maybe could be a great client, but happens to be in one of those states where they are not welcoming to maybe someone that would be working at your company on the project team, how would you approach that situation?
That's a really good question. I have been incredibly fortunate that I have not been asked or been or having to have that conversation with a client. But if I did, and I'm sure many people in the firm have had to have that conversation, I would approach it through the bigger framework of the UN Global Compact and how other organizations use that framework to create greater impact for their communities. So I would look at the city, I would look at their client population, their patient population, their target audience, and start to ask questions that hopefully will allow us to understand their position within that space. So when you ask who's your catchment area, who's your clientele, and who are you considering for that, you can start to pick at where they are and maybe ask questions about how they feel about MBEs being part of the conversation within our team. I think there are ways to extract some tidbits that will help you hopefully understand where they're coming from so that you bring them along to the conversation and you just not necessarily flat out ask, how do you feel about DEI or how do you feel about these things? I've learned recently that starting conversations, I've been told, that hasn't happened to me, but you probably don't want to start, how do you feel about gender-affirming care and spaces in your restrooms? That's a hard conversation to have, of course, but we can start to talk about, how do you feel about inclusion? How do you feel about inclusive spaces? Which spaces do you feel need to be looked at through this lens? And you sort of pull at that thread until you feel there's enough comfort and you feel courageous enough and you feel that the client is receptive enough to have conversations. But usually in the project, within the RFPs, you can start to see a little bit of that. There are many RFPs that have very clear idea about who their target audience is, who they want you to partner with, especially MBEs, what kind of MBEs. So I'm asking you, what is your involvement in the community? How are you supporting particular communities? And if that isn't there, usually when you know that your clients are vast, that needs to be part of the conversation. So I know for me, it wouldn't be an issue. I imagine that for others, there's a comfort level in doing that. So for those that don't feel terribly comfortable, because of course I'm showing up like director of Jedi, so they know what they're going to get. But if you're not comfortable with that space, I would start asking questions about who they want to impact, how they want to impact, and to consider that impact is always beyond the property line. It's always beyond that boundary. And to consider the work that they're doing for decades, if not centuries. Especially developers may not necessarily think through that lens, but more people to want to inhabit that space, it's good for the bottom line at the end. So people, planet, profit. You kind of have to pick.
Just in case someone didn't know, MBE, that stands for Minority Business Enterprise. It's a certification, I guess, right?
Yes, it is a certification. It is an organization, firm, or corporation certification that the state or the local authority grants an organization through very specific metrics. So you have minority-owned businesses, disadvantaged-owned businesses, small minority businesses, women-owned businesses, LGBTQIA. All of those businesses fall under this larger umbrella that the government tries to create space for these organizations because typically they are smaller and they don't have access to the same resources the large organizations have.
So for someone who is maybe working at a firm and they see that it's lacking in terms of diversity or inclusion, where would you recommend that they start? And I'm sure there's a lot of areas that they could work in too, in terms of, we talked a little bit about clients, but maybe in terms of staffing or recruiting, or they're not seeing diversity represented in leadership. What's like square one for someone to start their own grassroots organization?
I have for several years use this as the baseline, not only because I'm familiar with it, but because it's sort of an easy tool to use. It's the AIA Guides for Equitable Practice.
Okay.
What I recommend people that are interested in tackling this topic and may not have this conversation in their organization is to consider things like doing lunch and learns for a chapter a month, and having conversations about what is in each chapter. They're not super dense, but they're quite robust in the kind of information that is in there. It provides you with advice. It provides you with people's opinions, strategies, and what to do and what to consider. And if, for example, you were to start a book club or you know, lunch and learns that you curate, and slowly build that momentum, at the end of the chapters, you will have built a common language around a group of people that then become part of your village. So I imagine things like, you know, we start talking about, there's a chapter on recruitment. What if you started talking about recruitment, what that looks like in your organization, and ask questions. Do we go to HBCUs? What does that look like? Could I go to an HBCU? So it doesn't feel like you're really calling anybody out. You're just inquiring and you're wanting to be part of the change. You start bringing in leadership into the conversation, and hopefully you can start to share with them these guides, start a broader conversation, and slowly build capacity within your organization on an overall language and an intention around that conversation. Like, for example, what we did with the Jedi Champions at HKS is we had one champion in every office. I partnered them together across the globe. I gave them a chapter and I said, okay, now you have to present this for half an hour. And they curated amazing videos that now have become part of learning modules at the firm. What I love about that is they decided how they wanted to share that content with other people that in that moment felt like their community, their safe space. So because they felt like it was a safe space to talk about these issues, they were very honest and very clear, and they wanted this to really dig into the other people into their soul of what intentionality would look like at HKS to build an equitable practice. After that, there are labels like the JUST label, the UN Global Compact, B Corp. There are many frameworks out there that you could leverage to ask questions. Have we considered using the JUST label? Yes, no, it's really time consuming. So I understand many organizations would say no, but you can download the guidebook and you can look through it. You can also do the same thing and divide it up amongst people. The AIA, when I was in the New Urban Agenda Task Force, we help support a grant that studied several equitable development frameworks like Policy Link, Century 21st. And you can also utilize some of those resources to understand maybe not how you may tackle changing your organization to be more equitable right now, but you could potentially position your firm to use some of these frameworks to activate their projects. Like Policy Link has great resources, Century 21 as well, the EPA. So you may already be familiar with some of these things through a different lens, like sustainability or resiliency. A lot of these are starting to change and upgrade, I would say, their language to include environmental justice, climate impact for underserved communities. The WELL now has the WELL Health Equity Scorecard. So there are other places and other things that you could inquire about opportunities to take WELL and be engaged and then be part of that conversation and bring it back to the firm and say, hey, I learned about this. Could we test it out in a project? And then ultimately, you may even become the go-to person, that lead person that manages that content, and you slowly build your own direction and your own leadership style in the firm.
Those are great tips. So if you have goals and ideas but don't know where to start, that framework, and I can link that in the show notes too, of maybe just start with a chapter a month, and it's a whole year of effort, but yes. I don't think that change is really going to happen tomorrow. You really have to build upon it, have conversations, get buy-in from leadership. So that's a great tip and a great way to dip your toe in and then get ready for that dive in.
Yes, it is a dive in the deep end, but it's worth it. It's worth it.
Oh, of course. I'm sure you have a lot of things that you are working on at HKS in terms of what issues you're trying to tackle. Do you have any that maybe were successful or that you're working on right now that are especially close to your heart?
There are several, but they're always in progress. I can be very competitive with myself, and I can never imagine that anything is done and over with. Never anything's perfect. But there are a few things that we've done that bring me a lot of joy. And it was the development of the JEDI metrics report, where we shared internally all of our metrics, mm-hmm. filtered through race, gender. We celebrated LGBTQIA representation by the people that had chosen to volunteer that information, disability status, veteran status, how many countries are sort of embedded within our organization, languages, and what do our metrics look like without judgment? This is just a baseline. This is where we are today. This is what our leadership looks like. This is generationally, this board, practices, sectors. And through the years, we did that in 2021, I believe. I can't remember now. And people have used it. People continue to reference that document. We were able to create a website, a microsite called esg.hksinc.com. And we continue to upload current data for what we're doing, how we're doing it. We invited two NOMA Foundation fellows, fantastic. We've had a JEDI summer intern that has done phenomenal research, Julia Cho. And she's been working on gender affirming care and spaces within healthcare. And there was a client ask from Texas and California that said, yes, we know that there's work happening around public spaces and restrooms in public spaces, but what happens to the clinicians and the physicians in the back of house? where all spaces are pretty much gendered, right? If you're in a clean corridor, or if you're in a dirty corridor and you have to go into an OR, you choose a door to go through restrooms and lockers to go to come out to the other side clean. And the clients were saying, so what do we do with our own people? How do we support our own people? And I fell in love with that question. And Julia has been doing great work. She worked on that with Syracuse University. She's now pursuing her master's in Princeton. And she just said, I want to do this work. I just want to do the research. So I'm incredibly proud of her and the work that she's doing, because it is helping us with greater language. So not only is that helping inform design for our firm, but we can use it as a conversation with our clients. And one of the things that we sort of define, because we're speaking at the healthcare design conference, is when you solve for one, you extend to many. And that's what she's working on right now, is we started the conversation around gender-affirming restrooms and gender-inclusive spaces. But what we learned is that's a swath of every identity, right? You can have non-binary people that cross race, ability, age. So every time we make an intervention, we do have to consider intersectionality. And I love that she chose to come back and continue doing that work. We are working on developing scholarships. We have an HBCU alumni network now internally. We've defined some goals, not quotas, but just progress. How are you achieving progress on our commitments? We have two affinity and inclusion groups that are doing amazing work. The Pride AIG submitted for the Corporate Equality Index for the Human Rights Campaign. We hope to get 100. And I think we've slowly built a network of people that care, and care so much that they volunteered to do research on this. We did 2 years worth of research. We had two incubators around framework for equity and ethos of equity within education. And they did amazing work. They came together in an accelerator and they developed a toolkit to create spaces for belonging within higher education. And they presented at South by Southwest this year. And now we're going to utilize that toolkit on projects. I think one already used that toolkit at UTA. And this is the kind of thing that we hope permeates throughout the firm. That we start with, you're interested in this, you're interested in the council. Why are you interested in the council? You're interested in mentorship, in reviewing the employee manual for compliance. What are you interested in doing? And then connecting people. I feel like you and I are very similar. We just want to give people an opportunity to share what they love and then give them a platform to do that. So for me, that's been my joy, is really listening or being yelled at, which is totally fine, about what people need, and then curating spaces for them to create whatever it is that they want to create and impact the firm and the industry as they wish. It's about them, not me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it comes back to creating a network, creating connections, and then also just you're amplifying people's voices too, especially through your work at HKS, but also then we talked about a little bit earlier, but Wield and La Idea. Have you seen it amplify specific voices within the DC community through the programming or connections that have been made?
I do all the time, but that's sort of like a trick question, because I have seen them engage. I have seen them thrive. So I have seen them grow. Like Mika, who is now at Perkins and Will, we started having conversations. She just called me and said, I want you to be my mentor. And I'm doing all of these things. And it was because she wanted me to present at HOK during Diversity Week. And we just started talking like every other month. And she was doing a project on Instagram. And I realized how much energy and passion she had for this work. So her asking me to be mentor actually enabled me to be mentored by somebody that had all the energy and the passion, and it provided me an opportunity to lead differently. Because now I needed to cool down. Now I needed to be more level-headed and be more proactive in how to support a person that is driven just like I'm driven. And I asked her to be part of WIELD and chair the committee. And she created a 3-part series on immigrant architecture. And it was spectacular. And it just became this grassroots conversation of me just saying, you can do this. Trust me. Mm-hmm. You're more than capable of doing this. And not only are you more than capable of doing this, I know you're going to make something amazing. And I was in a weird way, although she would probably disagree completely, I was living vicariously through her as if I had just started doing this work again. And I wasn't in a corporate space. I was still sort of building the committee and seeing her thrive and seeing her sort of blossom and grow and now move on to greater leadership roles is just so thrilling. And building the our forum, our impact, connecting NOMA with La Idea, with us, with WIELD, with ADU, and creating these coalitions of people that have so many similarities in how they show up because of their identity or their affinity, and connecting them and seeing them build something greater than themselves, but also uplifting their own messaging through that. It always brings me joy that we were able to do all that through the pandemic, because it was right in the middle of the pandemic. And yeah, just mentioning to them, do you want to apply for the AIA Young Architect Award or the National Associates, the Associates Award for National? Do you want to be part of the board? And they look at me like, can I? Because they feel like they're too young in their profession or they haven't accomplished everything. They have. Just because they're already there, their willingness, the asking just brings me so much joy to be part of their journey in some way.
Well, that's huge. That I think, first of all, a lot of people are intimidated to ask someone for mentorship, especially you have a lot going on. So for Mika to step up and go, I want you to be my mentor. I see what you're doing. I love it. That takes a ton of courage that I think a lot of people would look and go, oh yeah, she's probably too busy. Like
I am. It's not, it's true. I'm ridiculously busy, but I will make time. I know what it means. I wish I would have had that. I know what it means. And my wife is just like me. So we don't sleep. And I would rather be part of somebody's journey to success mm-hmm. because it ultimately is my own success than just not take the time. And mm-hmm. I will do my best. Yes, I can't commit to meeting people every week or every month, but I will be there when you need me. And I will do my best to be that because I know other people will do that for me and have done that for me.
Which is outstanding. And it seems like too, it's not a one-sided interaction too. There's a lot that as a mentor, you benefit from your mentee yeah. where you're learning kind of, oh, I didn't know this about myself or about the industry. Mm-hmm. And that relationship is really two-sided. Would you say that it's important for people as they get more advanced in their career that they try to also be a mentor and give back?
Absolutely. I'm in mid-40s and it's so easy to forget what it looked like and what it felt like to be in my 20s, starting out in the industry. Mm-hmm. That felt enormous. It was sort of unfathomable to consider having a grasp on what the industry, even the architecture field, could be and where I was in that space. What was my place in the conversation? It's really easy to forget because you're constantly trying new things. You're moving along. You're focused on different things. Mm-hmm. And remembering where you were, remembering where you come from, remembering that it's not easy to get to where you are. I think it's always so important. It builds a lot of empathy. It reminds you of struggles. It reminds you of what you wish you would have had at that moment, mm-hmm. how you wanted to be heard. It's inevitable to forget those things when you're overwhelmed with work. When you're a manager, You're thinking about so many things. You're worried about so many things, about so many people. You have to look up and you have to look down, and it can be incredibly overwhelming. And we know after every recession, there's an exodus from organizations. So yet again, we need more people in leadership roles, and it's never enough. But talking and reminding yourself of how you would have wanted to be heard and seen, and what it looks like for you to do that now. I can't imagine a better way of doing it than just talking to people that are in that moment and in that space where you can feel it and you remember that. I think the future of architecture is going to be less technical, because a lot of these things will likely be automated. I think there's still an incredible capacity for technical excellence that is required. But the day-to-day, I see it as becoming an industry more about collaborators, facilitators, about conveners, about the people that are able to hear and translate what other people are feeling and seeing and wanting into spaces where they can thrive. And we've done that. But I think now the conversation is really rooted in those soft, we call it soft skills. I think there's very strong, amazing skills. I think growing our capacity in those skills while still maintaining technical excellence is the future of our industry. And it is about connection. It is about vulnerability. It is about empathy. It is about resiliency, not only for the building, for people, for the communities. And what better time and place to listen to what's really going on is to listen to the next generation of leaders that have this in the tip of their hands. I listen to them talk in interviews, when they message me on LinkedIn. ESG is what they really care about. Yes, they want to do beautiful buildings that do these other things. So we have to keep our ears and our hearts open. And yeah, if we stay in our silos, we're just going to create more silos, and nothing good comes out of silos.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Well, I can't ask any more questions to hinge on that, but I will go through a quick round of rapid fire questions, which are just a mixed bag of random things that I have discovered in my research about you.
Oh.
So I hope you don't mind.
Go for it.
I know you're from Puerto Rico. What is your favorite work of architecture in Puerto Rico?
My favorite building in Puerto Rico is the Caribe Hilton Hotel. It was one of the first, if not the first, modern Caribbean architecture hotel. It's a little bit contentious, as many things, because of its location, but it still reminds me of what beautiful, autochthonous, like, how do you say that in English? Authentic, mm-hmm. folkloric architecture can look like in Puerto Rico, in the Caribbean, by Toro Ferrer Architects in Puerto Rico. It always reminds me of the power of architecture and what it meant to be a Puerto Rican architect designing Puerto Rican architecture in the 40s.
I'll have to include a link to that in the show notes of what that building looks like. I think it's kind of like the wavy.
Yes, that okay. one.
So I did my thesis project in Puerto Rico.
Mine too.
Was it?
Yes. My thesis was the El Último Trolley. The park that borders the very, very luxury, high-end community in Ocean Park, the projects at the bottom, Luis Llorens Torre, and the Carolina, a community that is sort of, I guess it's in between, right? Middle, upper-ish. And the park is in the middle, and it's never really fully utilized, because it's the intersection of these things. And it was created intentionally that way by Luis Muñoz Marín, our governor, because they wanted all of these communities to mix in a utopian society. So I want to know everything about your thesis yeah. now.
Yeah, I can give a quick summary. I really liked international expositions. And I thought the United States is not really even part of the committee anymore, so we're not hosting them like we used to in the past. But I thought, I forget if the hurricane or there was an economic recession going on in Puerto Rico at the time of my thesis. And I thought, it could be a great way to bring kind of development, excitement for Puerto Rico, to host an international exposition there. And then I talked a lot about like master planning and infrastructure, and it would transition. A lot of the international expositions become like wastelands afterwards.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'll master plan it so that buildings won't just be kind of pop up, pop down, but integrated into a successful urban development. So I had reached out to some Puerto Rican architects. So I went down and I talked about the sites with them and picked one and was trying to be very, you know, get local input of, you know, I don't want to just like come down from Pennsylvania of like, I think it should be here. But, you know, identified some sites of what size I needed and then talked with some local folks. And that was my thesis project.
That is spectacular. Yes. On another, we're going to talk more because I'm
okay. Yeah.
thank you for considering all of those things at a time when probably everybody was welcoming hearing your interest in that kind of work. Oh my gosh. Thank you. I'm like, you're just feeding my soul right now.
Oh, well, that's great to hear that you like the idea. I never wanted it to be kind of like sometimes you're young and it's, this is what I think should go here. I tried to do as much research into the tourism industry and benefits and this, that, and the other of kind of what could happen. So yeah, we'll share that some other time. But okay, other random questions. I know you're a Harry Potter fan. Which house are you?
Oh, Gryffindor. But technically, technically I am the Gryffindor Slytherin. I'm right, the merge. You know, that J.K. Rowling had said that there are mergers in many of these.
Yeah.
So I feel I am fully Gryffindor, but it's really kind of in between. I have some Slytherin in there.
Okay. But you would probably choose, had the hat given you the option.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
How did you? That's so funny. I just put this. This is terrible. I had a friend custom made a wand for
you. Oh,
this is so tragic.
You've been holding that the whole time.
No, I... Yes.
It was in your sleeve.
It was in my sleeve. No,
a
very dear friend custom ordered this for me.
For people listening, it's a wand. Giselle just pulled a wand out of her sleeve.
It's a wand. It's a custom, and it even has all the information. It doesn't have a phoenix feather or anything. My friend was very lovely. So she surprised me with one of these, and I was cleaning this room and I found it and I have it not to use, although thank you. But I have it right here as a reminder of good friends.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. And then my last question is the AIA COVID-19 task force. You are part of that. What were just like one or two of the issues that you discussed or were trying to, like, I'm sure that was just like, oh my gosh, yes. What do we do?
I was fortunate enough to be part of the board, and I talked to the AIA president at the time, Jane Frederick, and I had heard several conversations within the Institute around how can we support several movements that were happening through our skill set, of course. And one of the things that was going on, we now know this very well, was the Army Corps of Engineers was creating those pop-up hospitals to tend to COVID patients. And what we learned is that the engineers had come up with a very, very quick framework to support this. So we asked to be included as part of the conversation to gather information from healthcare practitioners and researchers and provide them with an additional set of resources through our lens so that their guidelines that were going to be then transitioned all over the world for all of the bases and all of the places that the United States has a base or an embassy in, that we needed to provide those same level of resources. So my task force was specifically around the alternative care sites that were being designed in the US and then later on. And so my intervention was more about helping support the creation of those guidelines. But for me, what was most important, knowing that these alternative care sites were going to happen all over the US and the world, was considering cultural appropriateness for these things, for the unhoused population, for lack of language, lack of understanding similar languages. So my role was to add those considerations, those cultural considerations to the toolkit that then got translated into, I think, 3 or 4 languages and sent abroad by the Department of State. So things that I wanted to acknowledge were, you know, what do the unhoused population need? They usually carry around a lot of things. So we need lockers for them. We need spaces for people that don't speak English and translators. What is that going to look like? Some people arrive with a big family. We need to create spaces for them. So there, we started sprinkling some of these things into the conversation. I was able to bring in and collaborate with Gabrielle Bullock, several people at HKS, even our writing team and mental and behavioral team came on board, because if you're, and we imagined that that would not happen, but in case you have a COVID patient that needs some mental health support, sure, you need a different set of guidelines to support them. So I brought them in to help and curate some of that content and be part of the change. And it was just, I was at the right place at the right time. And I asked the right question to the right person at the right time to be engaged in that work.
Mm-hmm. That's spectacular. Well, we have a chock full episode, so I'm not going to ask any more, even though I probably could. Giselle, thank you so much for sharing your time with me on this episode and running through all of these questions and just elaborating on everything. It's so nice to finally meet you. And I'm so excited that we're both in DC. So we will definitely run into each other in the future.
Absolutely. Well, we will in the future. I thank you for the opportunity to do this. I'm flattered that you were considered me for this. I'm honored. And also thank you for creating these platforms and elevating an overall conversation. You're phenomenal at this. It's fantastic. So thank you. Thank you for that. And I really wish for you that this really takes off and it shows the world your kind of leadership that I'm very excited to see. Thank you. And this is awesome.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Architect Ed. If you enjoyed the episode, don't forget to share it with your network, leave us a 5-star rating and review, and follow us on social media. Reach out to the podcast directly at architectet.com. That's architect, E-T-T-E.com. Join us in 2 weeks for our next episode. See you then.